Judiciary. Appreciate your patience. We had a floor session that ran long today and adjourned about 1 o'clock, so we needed to give the members a chance to grab a bite to eat and check back in with their offices. And so we are ready to begin the hearing today. And we're going to start with a public hearing on House Bill 2075. And I'll open that public hearing now. Council?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, House Bill 2075 was introduced at the request of the Joint Interim Committee on Judiciary for the Oregon State Bar Business Law Section. It seeks to amend the Oregon Business Corporations Act, adopted in 1987, to bring it into compliance with the new Model Business Corporations Act, which has been updated by committee over a period of time and has been approved by the American Bar Association Business Law Section. Most of the proposed amendments are technical in nature or are intended to clarify existing law. There are some changes dealing with director liability, however.
Okay. Witness list. And we will start with Robert R. and Andrew J. Morrow from the Oregon State Bar. If you'd both come forward, that would be terrific. Good afternoon and welcome.
Thank you. Chair Williams and members of the committee, my name is Andrew Morrow. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland, and I am the legislative chair of the business law section of the Oregon State Bar. As counsel indicated, the House Bill 2075 was the result of work of a task force of the section reviewing changes to the Model Business Corporation Act. The present Oregon Business Corporation Act, which is Chapter 60 in ORS, was adopted in 1987 based upon the Model Act as it was in effect at that time. The section periodically takes responsibility for reviewing the changes to the Model Act and suggesting amendments to the Oregon Business Corporation Act based upon that, and that's the genesis primarily of the first part of this bill, basically sections 1 through 14. In addition, the second part of the bill deals primarily with conversions and mergers and deals not only with corporations but other entities, including limited liability companies, cooperatives, partnerships and limited partnerships. In 1999, the legislature approved some changes which allows mergers among those entities as well as conversions among them. In 2001, there were some modifications made to allow for better interstate transactions among those kinds of entities. And the second part of the bill deals with some technical changes to those provisions. The third part of the bill is actually one change to the Oregon Control Share Statute, which deals with limiting acquisitions or requirements for acquisitions by public corporations in the state. Briefly, that's sort of the overview of where the bill came from. Bob Art is here, and he chaired the task force which prepared this legislation. In my written testimony, I've included a section-by-section summary of the bill as was printed with some reference to the amendments. There are actually two sets of amendments, Dash 2 and Dash 3. The Dash 2 amendments were proposed by our section, and the Dash 3 amendments came to from the Rural Electric Cooperative Association. We've reviewed those and made some suggestions that are incorporated here, so supportive of all of those. And I'll let Professor Art talk a little bit about substance.
Great, thank you. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you. Chair Williams and members of the committee, my name is Robert Ard. I'm a professor of corporate law at Willamette University and chair of the Corporation Act Committee of the Business Law Section of the State Bar. I've been part of the section's effort for years in working to keep legislation on corporations and other business entities up to date and efficient for Oregon businesses and their counsel. And I am currently chair of the committee that prepared the proposal that is now 2075. I submitted 3 pages of material that is a summary of that. Here, briefly, are the major points. Newer forms of communication have developed that the Corporation Act, as presently written, does not provide for such things as fax and email. The bill facilitates use of those new forms for submissions of documents to the corporation section, the corporation division of the state government, as well as notices to shareholders and directors. The Model Business Corporation Act has had a number of amendments over the years. The bill adopts changes from that in areas such as procedures for shareholder meetings and the authority of committees of directors. These changes will just help keep Oregon in the mainstream of American corporate law. Cross-entity conversions and mergers are permitted and have been permitted for a few years now. For example, a corporation can merge with an LLC or can convert itself into a limited liability company. This bill resolves some ambiguities as to how those transactions work when one of the parties is from another state. And then finally, takeovers of corporations with publicly traded shares have been subject to special rules for many years. This bill clarifies some technical details as to how to count shareholders and assets. Mr. Joseph points out correctly that some of the MBCA, the Model Business Corporation Act, changes affected liability of directors. We considered, that is, this committee considered at length those provisions, decided not to go forward with them, so they are not part of this proposal. As a corporate law professor, I love this stuff. I could go on at length, but I won't.
You're calling Maury Holland from
University of Oregon.
Talking to us about rules of civil
Well, I will restrain myself, but would welcome an opportunity to answer any questions you might have.
Appreciate both of your testimonies, and I just referred the committee also to the last page of the materials that Professor Ard provided, which includes a list of the individuals who make up the Corporation Act Committee. Those of us from last session remember very well discussions, particularly with respect to small, closely held corporations and the process that the changes to those statutes went through. I note that none of the primary participants in that discussion are here testifying in opposition to this bill, which I think sends a signal that these are, in fact, really basic technical changes and changes to bring us in compliance with the Model Act and what other states have done. Can I ask a question, Professor? The fact that we meet every other year, and we approach this sort of updating of our Corporations Act, and there's usually some tinkering that goes on almost every legislative session, at least since I've been involved, even as a staff to the committee. Do you ever see situations where you think the fact that we meet every other year and therefore are sometimes potentially, you know, in anywhere from 12 to 18 months behind what other states have done with respect to their corporate form ever being a significant disadvantage in anything you've seen within the workings of the committee and some of the experiences that you've seen? And that's a question you can answer too, Andy, if you want to.
Chair Williams, I have not experience that difficulty. We are actually not absolutely current on the Model Business Corporation Act, even with these provisions. And there generally is a period of time among the various states to enact the most recent versions. So every 2 years has not been a problem from my perspective.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Andy, in the practice side?
Chair Williams, I think the experience has been that some of the issues that are most likely to be differences among the states tend to be some of those things that focus in on issues in terms of, you know, organizing in Oregon versus organizing in Delaware. One of those that came up dramatically and was addressed last session was the question of having shareholder meetings by consent without unanimity, and we did address that issue. The liability provisions that are in the Oregon statute now are probably the thing that might be most dramatic in terms of differences among the states. The provisions in terms of limitations on liability of directors are based upon the statute in Delaware, so they're very similar in that respect. The Model Business Corporation Act has done some changes to those liabilities. Given the climate now with all of the issues of Enron and other corporate accusations of wrongdoing in various places, it didn't seem an appropriate time to suggest changes to those provisions. So I think that we are doing a good job of keeping current and try to be attuned and focus in on those things that are likely to make some difference in terms of whether corporations stay here or go elsewhere.
Do you find that most of the states tend to follow the Model Act, or do they watch, to a great degree, Delaware more closely than they watch the Model Act?
Chair Williams, I would say that the corporation acts, tend to follow primarily the Model Act in terms of general provisions. I think Delaware is observed, and sometimes some other jurisdictions where there are some dramatic changes, and nothing at this point, steps out as being that kind of dramatic change. We had that more in the era when, for example, the Oregon Controlled Share Statute and the Business Combination Statute were enacted, and there it became important to get those changes to attract corporations and keep them incorporated in Oregon. And in the past, responded to those kinds of situations.
Thanks. Other questions? Representative Shirley.
Thank you, Chair. I'd like to ask a question just right into the text of the bill on page 4. Beginning at line 9, leading into the new language. This deals with the special meeting request. And the way I understand this now, of course, now you've got the request of 10% of all votes entitled can request a special meeting. Then we're adding the provision allowing the Articles of Incorporation to adjust that percentage. And then on line 14, we have this new language: unless otherwise provided, a written demand for a special meeting may be revoked by a writing to that effect received by the corporation prior to the receipt by the corporation of a demand sufficient to require the holding of a special meeting. And I guess my question is, revoked by whom? I mean, does it have to be the exact same 10% or 20% or 25% of the shareholders who made the request? Surely wouldn't be some other 10% that would have the authority to revoke another 10%'s request for special meeting, or else you'd never have the minority. I guess you'd never be able to call. What's the thinking there? Is there an identity between the shareholders making the request and the shareholders entitled to revoke that request?
Representative, or Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly, my interpretation is that the person who makes the request revokes the request, rather than someone else revoking.
Representative Shetterly.
And that's easy, I guess, in closely held corporations. But when you're in, when you've got several shareholders or hundreds of shareholders, do we need to make it clear that it has to be the same shareholders who have made the request who have to then revoke it? And the other question, I guess, is I'm wondering why the revocation has to get there before the demand. The way I read this language, the revocation has to get there before the demand. And if we're giving them the ability to revoke, if it's the same ones requesting the special meeting, why not give them the authority to revoke that request even after it's been received by the corporation?
Chair Williams, Representative Shetterly. I think the answer to the last part of the question in terms of the timing has to do with the ability to have some point at which this process is final or not. I guess the analogy I might give in another context is the process of getting a written consent. Once the consent is submitted to the corporation with shareholders sufficient to pass the provision, signing it, it becomes effective, and it can't be revoked at that point. I think that the intention of drafting this way in that respect is to make sure that at some point the process is final and one can move forward. One knows that you have a demand that's sufficient to require some action on the part of the corporation in calling the meeting.
Okay. Mr. Chair. Then how about the first part, the issue then where you've got multiple shareholders and that 10% can be made up of several different combinations of shareholders. Do we need to make clear that the revocation has to be by the same 10% that made the request? Or maybe not 10%, maybe 25% depending on what you've got.
Chair Williams, Representative Shetterly. The way I read this, and it may be worthy of some clarification, was that the revocation was really an action by the shareholder who submitted a request, so that if, for example, I'm one of the people who signs on to this request, I change my mind, I can pull back my part of the demand. And really that I was reading this as a right to revoke one's own submission.
And I guess that's, as I read it, that's sort of the same, just on the usage. You cannot revoke what wasn't yours to give in the first place. So if you haven't given something, you can't seem to revoke it. The word revoke, to me, seems to suggest that only if you have sort of given it are you in a position to take it back.
I'd like one of those.
This small musical interlude, courtesy of Bill Joseph, committee counsel.
And I understand that, I guess, but the only, maybe it is worth clarifying, because where you're giving the right to request and the right to revoke, you're giving them to percentages of shareholders. And maybe it'd be an easy clarification that a shareholder who has executed a request for a demand for a special meeting can revoke his or her signature or demand, whatever the case may be. Give that in and make that an individual right, because this relates to the demand, which I sort of see as being the document rather than the signature, maybe, because there may be several signatures on a request or demand for a special meeting.
Professor Andy, either of you have a comment?
Chair Williams, Representative Shetterly, I would not object to that clarification. There's a question of whether that meaning is inherent in it as written, but if you'd prefer it to be more explicit, I don't object to that at all.
Mr. Chair, I won't vote no on it if everybody else wants to go on. But I just thought it looked like it begged the question, who revokes?
Representative McPherson and Representative Cromwell.
I'm nodding over here because I think it can be read to have the intent that was described by the witness. I think that the issue has been identified, why not insert a reference to shareholder, a demand by a shareholder for a special meeting, maybe revoked?
Well, that cuts it. Since there are two of them, I think we're headed down amendment row. Representative Krummel.
Well, now that the lawyers have taken a shot at this thing, let me give a non-lawyer's perspective, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Because I was, it's amazing that, I guess great minds think alike, because I was reading that very thing as Representative Shetterly was starting to address it. It seems to me that it is, it seems to me that it is a very convoluted and very confusing statement. Not even a matter of who's revoking what, but also the logistics of it. So if it's saying that you have to revoke your demand for a special meeting before the demand reaches the corporation, that means, and if it's got to be done in writing, that means that you have to figure out how far in advance your revocation has to be in front of the demand. I know I probably didn't say that right, and I probably said it as confusing as the statement is, but I would agree with Representative Shetterly that an explicit statement from a standpoint of who's revoking what and the timing of it would probably be a good thing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes,
it's just interesting. It's a drafted thing. I realize the problem is this is all in the passive. And usually legislative council, I thought, lately has gone more to the active voice. And this is all in the passive. And I think that's where the ambiguity comes from.
Well, we can certainly... Professor, you want to... Is this language modeled off the Model Act language, or is this homegrown?
Chair Williams, I'm fairly certain that this is Model Act language, although I'd have to check to be absolutely sure. But changing this to clarify and to use passive or to use active voice as suggested, without deviating from the Model Act's purpose, would not be objectionable. One possibility would be to draft the sentence to say, unless otherwise provided in the Articles of Incorporation, a shareholder who makes a written demand for a special meeting may revoke that demand by a writing, and then leave the rest of the sentence as it is.
We may send you down to chat with the drafters and the Legislative Council about this particular sentence, and to work with Mr. Joseph in preparing an amendment. Are there questions from this side of the dais on this bill? Representative Jensen.
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Nothing, I'm sure, is deep and complex as Representative Shetterly has brought up, but I'm struck a little bit at what seems to be kind of mushy language in Section 5.3, the meeting shall be fair to the shareholders. I'm not sure what fair is in this, and is that for some judge in the future on a case-by-case basis to determine what was fair?
Chair Williams, Representative Jensen, yes, fair is a very... open-ended term. There was no provision previously that described how the shareholders' meeting is to be run and who presides. So corporations just made the decisions on their own. This provision provides for a chair, allows the chair to make rules without compelling, for example, Robert's Rules of Order, can use whatever rules the chair selects, but must be fair, a rather open-ended term, as you point out, that at least provides a possibility for a shareholder who feels aggrieved to get judicial review. which would not be possible, or at least would not have a statutory basis without a term like this.
Is that a sufficient answer, Representative Jensen, for your...
There
is, to a certain degree, any of these things, you have to leave some discretion for the individual circumstances of the situation to be decided by a judge. And my suspicion is, as for any rules, at some point you would see something that would say that if you were operating the meeting by something like a Roberts Rules of Orders approach, you would find courts determining that that was a fair set of rules to run a meeting because it's accepted practice, and you would see sort of a movement that direction. But it doesn't mean it would be exclusive, and it would be up to the individual situation. And if you were in a minority shareholder position, you would want the ability to have this right to go back in and argue to a court that if the person running the meeting didn't allow for any comment on something, that would not be fair, and you would want some way to resolve that.
So it's a case-by-case basis.
On that particular issue, I think it probably is. Further questions? You want to speak at all? I know you mentioned, Mr. Morrow, just briefly, the two sets of amendments. I think the Dash 3s are the ones you indicated are offered by the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperatives Association, and we're going to bring them up to talk in just a moment. But the Dash 2s are amendments that have been put forward by the bar section. Is that right?
Yes.
And do you want to just briefly touch on what the Dash 2s do?
Well, primarily, the description was sort of incorporated in our discussion before, because these are primarily some things that were corrections in terms of what got processed in the legislative council process. I think, candidly, I think I was guilty of not getting some information back to council in the pre-session filing process in a timely manner, and so we found some corrections. For example, at the bottom of the first page of the Dash 2 amendments, there was to be an amendment to the Control Share Act, which is now identified as the new Section 17. That was not originally included in the bill that was pre-session filed and was added by amendment. So this is the process of our review and some additional comments that were received after the time that the pre-session bill was prepared. As I think you know, at this point, the bar's process requires us to have things submitted in May of last year. So.
Right. Okay. Thank you. Why don't we go ahead and bring forward and have you two remain at the witness table and ask Jack Evans from the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperatives Association to come forward. Welcome, Mr. Evans.
Thank you, Chair Williams, members of the committee. I am Jack Evans. I'm with the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association, and I'm sitting in today for our director, Sandy Flicker, who is in Washington, D.C. And Sandy has been working with the Oregon State Bar on an amendment that corrects a problem for us that occurred in the 1999 statutory changes to the definition of a business entity, in which the electrical cooperative, or in which co-ops are defined only as for-profit organizations, and the issue becomes a problem for us in that we interpret that as preventing non-profit cooperatives from being able to merger. That's currently an issue, as all of our cooperatives are not for-profit organizations, and two of them in Lane County, Lane Electric and Blatchley Lane Electric, are exploring a merger. And as their attorney began to prepare that, he noticed that this was a potential problem. So we've worked with the Oregon State Bar to come up with the Dash 3 amendments, which take the co-ops out of that list of for-profit entities under business entities definition and place them in a separate category. And that appears to resolve the problem for us. Today, when I got this language, I spoke with the attorney for the co-ops that will be handling the merger, and he was comfortable with it, except he raised a slight concern about the word and, which appears on line 23 of page 1 and subsequently in, on other pages that mirror that that change. The thinking is that in some way having "and" at the end of this list of for-profit corporations, then followed by the cooperatives, that it might in some way draw the cooperatives back into the list of for-profit entities in a subsequent statutory interpretation. However, in discussions with committee counsel and with legislative counsel, we feel that'd be a pretty far-fetched interpretation. And so, as long as the intent is to not prevent not-for-profit corporation cooperatives from merging, we're comfortable with this.
Okay, thank you very much. Are there questions for Mr. Evans? All right, we have your testimony as well, Mr. Evans, in front of us, and appreciate that, and appreciate the bar's willingness to work with Rural Electrics on this bill to help them with the friendly amendment. I think what we're going to do, given the desire of several of the committee members to have Section 3 of the bill further clarified and put perhaps in a more active voice to address the concerns raised by Representative Shetterly, McPherson, and Crummell, I'm going to ask Legislative Counsel, with the assistance of Mr. Joseph, to prepare an amendment. At that point, what they will likely do is they will combine the dash 2s and the dash 3s into a single amendment, which will probably be numbered the dash 4s. And then we'll bring the issue back for a further work session for the adoption of those amendments. It doesn't seem to make any sense, really, to rush to adopt the other two amendments until we have just one package back with a single amendment. So that's what I would recommend. Is there any further discussion or questions for the panel? Okay, thank you very much. Hearing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2075. And Mr. Joseph, you'll work on getting that amendment drafted. Thank you. We're now going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2204. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, House Bill 2204 was introduced at the request of the governor for the State Forestry Department. It expands the crime of criminal trespass in the first degree to include entering or remaining unlawfully on private property that has been closed to protect water quality. And it prescribes types of language that should be used on signage used to close such private property. And it allows the Department of Forestry, Department of Agriculture, and the Department of Fish and Wildlife, as well as soil and water conservation districts, to assist landowners in closing such properties.
Thank you. And our witness, we only have one signed up, Greg Klein of the Department of Forestry.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Greg Klein, Forest Practices Program Director for the Oregon Department of Forestry. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of House Bill 2204. The Department of Forestry has been very committed to assisting landowners, forest landowners, in meeting water quality standards and improving fish habitat. And part of that commitment through Executive Order 9901 was the Board of Forestry created an advisory committee called the Forest Practices Advisory Committee. And one recommendation that came out of that was looking at developing a road closure program to assist small landowners and actually large forest landowners in addressing the issue of unauthorized road use that results in damage to streams of the state, and it degrades water quality. Roads can be a significant issue that degrades water quality. Forest landowners, though, through the Forest Practices Act, have done an excellent job of using the best management practices defined in the Act to protect water quality through examples such as water bars and drainage structures. Unauthorized road use, though, can undo those sorts of practices and result in damage to waters of the state. Many landowners, especially in eastern Oregon, have roads that are located close to streams. And this proposed change would add another, I would refer to it as a tier to the trespass law, allowing landowners to designate roads that potentially could impact water quality and would increase the, I guess, punishment level related to unauthorized road use. So from the Department of Forestry's point of view, this legislation would first strengthen a landowner's ability to, in, when they do issue a complaint by identifying or working with the three agencies listed in the bill to identify those roads, to post those roads with signs that specifically said closures related to protecting water quality, and then finally providing a notice in local papers that those roads have been closed. The second point is that, from my point of view, it's a preventative tool, and it also probably is an additional deterrent to unauthorized road use. The downside is there is a slight fiscal impact. I've estimated $5,000 over two bienniums related to purchasing signs that agree with the language in the bill. And the idea there, we would have those essentially ready for landowners to use. There potentially could be the reimbursement back to the agencies for the cost of developing those signs.
Are there questions? Representative Brzezinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Klein, I guess the only thing I question is, why are we wanting to put this as a Class A misdemeanor, as a criminal trespass in the first degree, as compared to trespass in the second degree? And I focus on, I guess, that question based on 164.270, which is a closure of premises to motorized propelled vehicles, which is a, from my quick reading, looks like it would go under the criminal trespass in the second degree as compared to first degree trespass.
Chair Williams, Representative Polanski. The issue there is, I think, for to provide the landowner a little bit larger hammer, if you will, to deter unauthorized road use. From my point of view, I think many landowners are felt a little bit frustrated that the fines imposed with the current trespass rule aren't stringent enough, and this would allow them to discourage that use.
Follow up?
Yes.
So are you saying that the current statute that's on the books for the closure based on motor propelled vehicles has not been effective in deterring individuals from violating that law?
Chair Williams, Representative Polanski. I don't have that quantified, and I think I need to work with the other agencies that I've mentioned and some other interests to verify that there is indeed an issue there. I have had conversations with the state police over the last day, and there seems to be we need to, I think, verify that where we need to go with that.
Perhaps it would be helpful, Representative Brzezinski, as a former prosecutor, if you'd take a minute and describe the difference in the penalty between a second-degree trespass and a first-degree trespass.
Thank you. I was going to actually follow up with that, because Class C, if I've got this correct, if I haven't forgotten, is 30 days in jail and or $1,000 fine. Mm-hmm. Class A is $5,000 fine or up to a year in jail. And jail is different from prison. It'd be in the county facilities or through a municipal facility. And I think at one point we get into work session, we may want to talk about whether or not $1,000 fine and or up to 30 days in jail should be sufficient or not.
And if I could, is it the department's view then that adding this particular the enters and remains unlawfully enter upon premises that have been closed pursuant to the statute using signs containing the words that it wouldn't be effective to have that be a Class B misdemeanor, is it Class A right now is what it would be, right?
Under this, yeah, under this would be a Class A.
So is a first degree trespass as opposed to a second degree trespass? I mean, the difference you think is a significant one?
From my viewpoint, with experience in Eastern Oregon, I feel it is. There's a concern, I think, with many landowners, forest landowners, and grazing interests of private property rights. And this would, I think, might be a beneficial to those landowners.
Any additional questions? I've got Representative Ackerman, Representative McPherson, and then Representative Park.
Mr. Klein, my questions sort of come from a legal perspective, so if you don't know the answer, I'll certainly understand, but I wanted to raise a couple of issues. Does the definition motor-propelled vehicle include motorcycles, motor vehicles, and other similarly propelled vehicles, or are we looking at four-wheel?
Chair Williams, Representative Ackerman. That would include, from my perspective, all motorized vehicles, motorcycles, potentially snowmobiles, four-wheel drive vehicles.
I know that there is these terms are defined in the Motor Vehicle Code. I didn't have time to cross-reference that, but I might want to look at that. My second question, if I get a follow-up, Mr. Chair, is if the driver does not see a sign, whether it's inadequate signage, would that be a defense to this offense?
Chair Williams, Representative Ackerman. I know the specific legal viewpoint there. My result would be is if it's not properly signed, then that would be a potential out for the potential defendant.
Okay. My third question is... property owner can request the assistance of the Department of Agriculture, Fish and Wildlife, Conservation Districts, and they can look at some signage problems. But then on page 24 of the second page of the Act, it says before October 1, publish in a newspaper of general circulation a notice regarding the closure of the premises. Why is that just hanging out like October 1? Why don't you just do the publication upon request? I don't see the significance of October 1 hanging out there.
Oh, sure. Chair Williams, Representative Ackerman. Really, we're focusing on the rainy season, which would essentially start in late October, November, and then it would be a period of time during the winter, and that's when the significant amount of damage would occur from this unauthorized road use.
Okay, that's the questions I have.
Okay, Representative McPherson, then Representative Parker, then Representative Shetterly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Klein, am I reading the bill correctly to allow a landowner, that is typically a private landowner, to without any sort of public certification or approval of the designation that protection is necessary for water quality protection, to in effect elevate the criminal sanction that would be applied to somebody who comes on their property without even any approval process that I can see here. Is that a correct reading?
Chair Williams, Representative McPherson. My thought on that it would have to be one of the agencies conferring with the landowner to specifically identify those roads that would potentially could impact water quality. And I think as far as the idea of an approval process to verify that, I think that's probably certainly doable.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Barker, then Representative Shetterly, and then Representative Jensen. We're going to have every, and then Representative Anderson, and then Representative Frank.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure. I mean, this seems a little bit wide of the mark. If we're really there just to protect the water, this seems like what we're trying to do is enhance the no trespassing, where for the hunters from, you know, from Portland driving over there and racing around. And I'm just a little concerned about that. I don't know. And then the sign is smaller than the piece of paper. And you know, when you're driving around, you might miss something like that. And the letter's 1 inch high, not less than 1 inch high. So I just have some reservations about it, and especially Class A misdemeanor is pretty heavy punch for that. If they're endangering the water, you know, that's great. Let's stop them and hammer them as we will. But a Class C would seem like a penalty would be more than adequate, even for somebody from Portland. $1,000 in 30 days would certainly have my attention, I think. But
I think we're Representative Jensen now. Am I right? Have I missed counted? I think Representative Jensen, you're next.
Am I next on them?
You are.
I have some pretty grave reservations about the proposed legislation. And some of the issues, I think, have been brought up and alluded to. I'm curious at what the rationale or reason the first question, allowing the landowners the right to go to OWEB to fund the production of the signs provided under subsection 1. This is very last section 3, number 2.
Chair Williams, Representative Jensen. I think that's an important question, specifically with the economic issues facing the legislature. We have, at least my fiscal impact, looked at providing funding for those sign production by the Department of Forestry. One of the ideas was, another measure, having that ability to work with local watershed councils and have a partnership where if this is important to a local area, the ability then to put a grant to OWEB for some funding to for the production of signs.
I'm not sure if I can continuation.
Certainly.
Sure. I'm not sure if these are important to a local watershed council that we need legislation to bring this about, since they already would have access to these avenues. I'm also curious and concerned, I think, about the issue of the timing of the protection, which you indicate is in what would be the winter months. And this will, in eastern Oregon, typically fall into at least part of the elk season period. While I could probably pick on the Portland hunters a little if people were to agitate me a little bit with it, it wouldn't be my intention to do that, since all of the hunters might be somewhat significantly caught by surprise by this legislation and this particular rule. And I'm a little bit curious too, Mr. Chair, if I may direct a question to the chair why this particular legislation would not have appeared before one of the natural resource committees that typically deal with these issues in more detail.
Representative Jensen, in response to your question, which I think is a good one, and as chairman of our water committee, I'm pleased that you're on this committee as we begin this discussion. I think it's because this bill creates a new crime. And to the extent that it creates an enhanced criminal penalty particularly at a time as each enhancement of a criminal penalty costs the criminal justice system money. I've been very clear with the Bill Assignment Office that if you're going to create a new crime, you need to send that or enhance a penalty. That bill has to come before the Judiciary Committee because of its impact on the criminal justice system. As you're fully aware, the difference between 30 days in jail and a $1,000 fine and up to a year in jail and a $5,000 fine, if the jail sentence piece of this was ever applied, or even if it wasn't, the fact that it had an enhanced penalty increased the likelihood that the crime would be prosecuted in a district attorney's office and that the community corrections people would be involved for the parole and probation aspect of this. There are system costs to any of those enhancements and penalties. So I think that's the reason that it ended up here. I'm the first one to tell you, Representative, that I think that on the substantive parts dealing with the actual idea of working with the watershed councils and the postings of the signs and those kinds of things, that's your ball of wax and not ours. I think the criminal penalty part is this committee's primary issue to focus on. And once we could figure out what we think that ought to be, I would be more than pleased to, after making an amendment to this bill, potentially referring it to your water committee if you would like to have it there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I do appreciate you know, the position on the criminal, and I do appreciate the costs that are involved, you know, with all of that. And I would like to ask that possibly you consider, as you've said, the referral on to either the Water Committee or the Ag Committee, Ag and Forestry, but clean water, since that's part of the Water Committee's Act jurisdiction, would
sure
be appropriate.
I understand. Representative Pozanski.
Mr.
I'm sorry, Representative Shetterly. I forgot.
Yes.
I got out.
I'll take my.
It's hard to keep track.
Yeah.
It's a busy day.
Well, thank you. Master, Representative McPherson asked my question. I think it is an issue as this bill gets a look that it does, I think, give a landowner the ability to just basically self-designate his or her property. I suppose I could put that up in my front yard and elevate class the criminal trespass. Section 3 does provide some sort of a process, but it appears to be voluntary. There's nothing that mandates it. Mm-hmm. And I guess the other thing is proportionality. I mean, obviously, this is here just for the purpose of elevating trespass on property that is protected for water quality to a Class A misdemeanor. And I don't know, and you mentioned the winter months, but I suppose on the summer months you're risking fire damage by motor vehicles on property, and is that a lesser risk? You know, should that just be a Class C misdemeanor while violating or trespassing that causes risk of to water quality as a Class A? So there's an issue there, too, I guess. It seems to be just part of the problem of taking this out and trying to deal with it discreetly through the criminal code like this. Mm. But those are just observations, I guess, if you're going to look at it.
Representative Pozanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I want to follow with what Representative McPherson brought up. My reading of 3, I don't even see any criteria as to how a landowner is actually going to determine whether it's going to somehow impact the water quality. I mean, what I see here is basically they have the opportunity to go to these agencies for their assistance as to when and where they may choose to close the premises. So, I mean, the bottom line is, it sounds to me this is so broad you could actually designate land that is not anywhere near water and actually enhance the penalty as it's written right now. I don't believe that was the intent, but I do believe the language that's currently there does not set any parameters as to what criteria would need to be met before that could even be enhanced.
Chair Williams and Representative Pulaski, if I could just answer that.
Yes, certainly. Absolutely.
Yeah, the intent was is only to post those roads that would significantly have an impact on water quality. It wasn't intended to be a blanket for any road on a landowner's property.
If I could, Mr. Chair?
You may.
I would just suggest that if you are looking at making amendments, you may want to set whatever criteria that's going to need to be necessary to be met, since this is not going to be something that's going to be determined by the agencies, but in fact could be left up to anyone owning the land or as the agent of the land to make those determinations. Thank you.
Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This may go a little further afield than is useful, but heck, I'll throw it out there anyway. just a suggestion as to what you might consider in restructuring the bill would be that since the conduct that we're attempting to prescribe here is the bringing of a motor vehicle onto certain properties, and it's not really the conduct of the individual other than bringing the vehicle there, mightn't a confiscation kind of penalty that is something related to the vehicle itself rather than incarcerating the individual who did it be a better kind of sanction? That is, for what it's worth, this is, I say, further afield than maybe is useful, but
having spent a considerable amount of time over the last several years in the issue of criminal forfeiture, Representative McPherson, I can tell you that while we might used to have been able to do that, we can't no more. It's a much more complicated issue. You'll recall that a ballot measure passed
Measure three
in the 2000 election cycle that entirely changed the way we approach criminal forfeiture statutes. And while your sentiment is good, I think the complications of that approach might not be worth the effort. That being said, Mr. Klein, I regret to inform you that your bill has slight problems in this committee, and I would encourage you. I'm going to certainly work with Representative Jensen, who chairs the Water Committee, to figure out a course of action. I would, without actually polling the committee, I'd suggest that there is some concern about the level of penalty increase and its proportionality as compared to similar kinds of penalties currently within the statute, and also some other issues obviously raised by Representative Jensen. So he and I will consult. I encourage you to chat with him as well to talk a little bit about the future of this bill. And because Representative Anderson hasn't yet spoken on this bill, I'm going to give him an opportunity.
Or in the water. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a parallel question, not relating to water quality or stream quality, but I assume that we have those same protections for the landowner for the forest itself, for the tree lot or trees and forests on a property where the owner can post and keep doing that. That's just what I guess Representative Barker was talking about, where a transgression of your property can be kept from occurring.
Chair Williams, Representative Anderson, you still have the trespass law in place, and you can post your property to prevent anyone from trespassing.
Right. The individual.
Just in terms of people, some of the folks that go in and spike a tree or sit a tree, they can be kept off that trespass law in general.
That's correct.
Representative Barker, did you have a further follow-up?
It appears to me, if I may, Mr. Chairman, this is just way too broad. If it's designed to protect water, that's one thing, but I don't see that. I mean, I think somebody could post a road because ruts will eventually puddle up and water will run off, muddy water will run off and things, and I don't think it's intended as some overbroad thing just to let somebody who wants to keep anybody but their friends out of their own hunting area or something like that. That's my concern. It's just too broad, I think. And the penalty, I think, is a little bit stiff for driving down a road.
Do you want to respond at all, Mr. Klein? Representative Barker's comment. I'll give you one more chance to talk to the committee.
Mr. Chair and Representative Barker, that's correct. This was supposed to be a fairly specific occurrence for those specific roads that would have significant impacts and not the broad brush approach. So I think it needs to have that tune-up.
Thank you.
And I appreciate the comments from the committee to improve this.
Well, we appreciate you bringing it forward. I've got a note from Representative Crummell pointed out to me that he's the only member of the committee who did not speak on the bill. And we'll go ahead and close the public hearing. on House Bill 2204. Colleagues, I've asked Mr. Joseph to go obtain copies of the amendment. I'll go ahead and open a work session on House Bill 2269. You'll recall this bill from previous discussion regarding the operation of non-testamentary trusts. Representative Shetterly, I think we paused our movement of this bill at your request, as I recall.
I think, Mr. Chair, as I recall, I had to leave during the testimony on this bill, but my suggestion was that it may be worth putting an emergency clause on this, having identified this as being good policy. I don't see any reason to wait 7 months or 8 months before it becomes effective. Certainly we have lots and lots of these trusts out there. I think it is good policy and would be worth making effective upon enactment by the legislature and signature by the governor. And I see that Mr. Joseph is distributing an amendment to do just that. So I appreciate the indulgence of the chair.
So before you is the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2269, which is simply adding an emergency clause to the bill. You'll recall briefly from this bill, this is the one, as I recall, Representative Shetterly, that included the language about the issue we spent the most time talking about in committee, as I recall, was the situation where you had the former spouse. Is this the former spouse inheriting?
No, that was the non-testamentary trust. That was the non. It was the survivorship bill,
Relating
to bank accounts and.
All right. So help us out and tell us what this one did again, would you?
Me?
Representative Shetterly.
Oh, this coordinates the rules regarding testamentary trusts with rules that govern wills.
There we go.
For general application, so that I think we're really coordinating wills and trust law here in a very helpful sort of way. I think it's a great bill.
But it does have the revocation of gifts to a former spouse following divorce language.
It does have that same concept in it.
Right.
That it was, and I think I commented on the fact that it had that issue, but that we had fully vetted that point in the prior bill discussion.
The inclusion of the afterborn children as trust beneficiaries.
Right.
Provision to make sure the trusts intend to qualify for federal tax, estate tax, marital deduction will so qualify even if incorrectly drafted. Okay. So we are in work session, and we have the Dash 1 amendment in front of us.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Move the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2169.
Representative Shetterly moves the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2269. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, we'll adopt the amendment, and we'll identify Representative Barker as being excused on the adoption of the amendment. Now the amended bill is in front of us.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Move House Bill 2269 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Shetterly moves House Bill 2269 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Just to observe on that issue that you mentioned, it's in Section 3, Sub 2 on line 23 at the beginning of the page, which is actually the correct way to state this, where the former spouse is treated as if the spouse had predeceased. And the other bill said it's treated as if the former spouse had disclaimed. And I think the other bill we're amending to mirror this language because this is what the law related to wills provides. So we'll have wills, trusts, and then these other non-will, or these will substitute instruments all passing according to the same rules.
Yeah.
So this one was right.
Okay, good. Thank you for the clarification. Ann, do you want to call the roll?
Sure. Representative Barker.
Excused.
Representative Johnson?
Here.
Aye.
Representative
Kozanski?
Aye. Representative Kozanski?
Aye.
Representative Chetterly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
I think so.
Yes.
Votes
aye. Joyce, you're the last one in the room, so you get to see these antics. We were worried Representative Jensen was going to move that the committee be adjourned until 11 o'clock tomorrow morning. Okay, House Bill 2269 is passed out of committee as amended. We'll go to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I'm looking at this end of the dais for a carrier. Representative McPherson, would you like to carry this bill?
I'd be delighted to carry this
bill. Okay. Representative McPherson will carry this bill. And that is the work of the committee today. We're adjourned.